From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Of the black people in America is inseparable from the problem of oppressed people all over the world.
And Malcolm X was assassinated 37 years ago today. W.E.B. Du Bois would be 134 on Saturday.
And the masses of the Negro people be in any possible way more quickly raised than by the effort and example of this aristocracy of talent and character? Was there ever a nation on God's fair earth civilized from the bottom upward? Never. It is, ever was, and ever will be from the top downward that culture filters.
Today, an African American History Month special. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Colombian Air Force jets bombed villages throughout the country today as the government said it's moving to retake a rebel enclave after a hijacking and abduction. An Air Force officer said pilots flying A-37 and AC-47 jets had flown 200 sorties out of an airbase in Meta Province, dropping 500-pound bombs on areas the government says are FARC strongholds. The Colombian President Andres Pastrana said in a television address to the nation he'd ordered troops to retake control of the guerrilla-held demilitarized area after midnight. Pastrana declared the Colombian peace process dead in the water, saying his government will put an end to all demilitarized zones. This news from Pakistan. A 21-year-old Pakistani man charged in the kidnapping of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl told the judge today the journalist was seized because he was anti-Islam and a Jew. In a closed-door deposition, Fahad Nassim admitted sending emails announcing Pearl's kidnapping on orders of British-born suspect Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh. Nassim was among three people arrested for sending the emails announcing Pearl's January 23rd abduction, which included photos of him in captivity. Nassim was brought to court with his head covered by a hood, surrounded by three dozen heavily armed policemen. Nassim gave his statement to the judge in a closed-door session, which even excluded his lawyer. The lawyer told reporters what his client had said based on the official transcript, which was not made available to reporters. Nassim was ordered jailed pending trial. Pearl is the Wall Street Journal's South Asian bureau chief. He was abducted on his way to a meeting in Karachi. Yesterday morning, military police in Italy raided four indie media centers in an attempt to seize all of the video and audio material related to last summer's protests against the G8. Specifically, they seem to be looking for any evidence linking police to last July's raid on the Genoa Media Center, as well as to the massacre at the Diaz Partini School. Yesterday's raids began early in the morning, apparently at the request of Genoa's attorney general. They continued throughout the day as police and riot gear seized computers, archives, and all the equipment that activists need for their daily cultural and political activities. We now go to Italy to Matteo Pasquinelli from the Independent Media Center. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Matteo.
See you. Hello to everybody.
Can you tell us what has happened?
Okay. To understand what has happened, we have to know that the TPO, the social center who was raided, is not only the base of Indymedia, it's also the base of the strong, movement, political, the strongest part of the political movement in Italy. It's also the base of whites, or the formerly whites overalls, and the base now of the disobedient movement. It's a social center with a strong consensus in the city, and so we have to understand and to know that this raided was motivated, was decided for political reason, and it was decided in Rome, I think directly from the Prime Minister and the Minister of Interior, for political reason and as a strategy to the tension.
And what exactly has been taken?
What exactly? From the legal point of view, it was an inspection to get tapes and videos. But in the TPO, all the areas in the social centers, all the area was inspected, and material also used by artists, material also books, and a lot of the things was brought away. The ride was happened at the early morning. It was not violent, and I want to repeat it was a ride interesting from a political point of view, and I think I want to underline that it's not only the indie media the cause and the reason of this raid.
Matteo Pasquinelli, I want to thank you for being with us from the Independent Media Center, the IMC, in Italy. You are listening to Democracy Now! As President Bush stood yesterday at the heavily fortified demilitarized zone dividing North and South Korea and decried despotism on the northern side, thousands of South Koreans gathered in downtown Seoul to protest his visit. Some carried placards depicting Bush with demonic horns and bloody fangs, while others chanted, "Bush, go home." The protests were the largest anti-U.S. rallies in years and contrasted starkly with the enthusiastic welcome Bush received in Tokyo, the first stop of his three-country Asian tour. The Washington Post reporting that Attorney General John Ashcroft cast the so-called war on terrorism in religious terms yesterday, arguing the campaign is rooted in faith in God, urging Christians, Jews, and Muslims to unite in the effort. President Bush had previously called the war a crusade. Contrasting what he called the way of God and the way of the terrorists, Ashcroft told a group of Christian broadcasters that civilized people, Muslims, Christians, Jews, all understand the source of freedom and human dignity is the Creator. Civilized people of all religious faiths are called to the defense of his creation. We are a nation called to defend freedom, a freedom that is not the grant of any government or document, but is our endowment from God. Close quote. These comments follow just weeks after Ashcroft stirred controversy by telling syndicated columnist Cal Thomas that, quote, "Islam is a religion in which God requires you to send your son to die for him. Christianity is a faith in which God sends his son to die for you."
Distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends and enemies. Distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends and enemies.
Friends and Enemies, the voice of Malcolm X by DJ Cam. Here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, I'm Amy Goodman. In 1965, the week before Malcolm X died, he wrote, "You have to realize that up until about 1959, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa and much less call us African. And in hating Africa and hating the Africans, we end up hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself." Those were the words of Malcolm X the week before he died. He was assassinated 37 years ago today in Harlem's Audubon Ballroom before a packed audience that he was addressing. Malcolm X has always emphasized the importance of knowing African-American culture and knowing history. In fact, he said history was the most important field of study. Well, today we're going to look at some sketches of African-American culture and history. The Wind on Gone is Alice Randall's unauthorized parody of Gone with the Wind, the 1936 epic saga by Margaret Mitchell that more than any other has defined many people's images of the antebellum South, of the Civil War. The renowned African-American scholar Henry Louis Gates calls it a classic parody, this new book, in a long line of literary creations that extend back to the ancient Greeks. Alice Randall wrote her version of Gone with the Wind, the classic story of Scarlett O'Hara, a headstrong Southern belle, from the perspective of Sanara, Scarlett O'Hara's half-sister, the daughter of a slave and a white plantation owner. Sanara's diary of life as a mulatto at Tara Mansion before the Civil War and during Reconstruction reveals the story left untold about the racial underbelly of Southern gentility. Randall's story brings to life the people who move on the margins of Gone with the Wind. The book is a scorning rebuttal to what author James Carroll called the most damning lie America has ever told itself, slavery. Today, we turn to a piece that was done about the Wind on Gone Alice Randall graduated from Harvard, moved to Nashville, became a country songwriter. She is the only African-American woman in history to write a number one country song and has recorded over 20 songs, including two top 10 records. But Randall had to fight the battle of her life against the Mitchell estate to publish her first novel, The Wind Done Gone. We're going to turn now to the story of the making of The Wind Done Gone. It was produced by the Radio Griot Project, which airs on Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. It's a piece that was written and narrated by Roy Hurst. The Making of The Wind Done Gone.
I didn't start loving him until he saw other. I didn't start loving him till he wanted her and me, but wanted me more. I didn't start loving him till he preferred me to her. Oh, God, I loved him then.
The Wind Done Gone and Ticked Off Gone with the Wind.
The Wind Done Gone, a blatant and wholesale theft of Gone with the Wind, is an unauthorized derivative work which incorporates and infringes upon the fully developed characters, settings, plot lines, and other copyrighted elements of Gone with the Wind, the Margaret Mitchell estate.
Alice Randall, girl, you gon' get it.
I did not want Gone with the Wind to sit on a shelf unanswered any longer, unresponded to, unrebuked, unscorned.
Even before Alice Randall's first novel, The Wind Done Gone, could be made available in bookstores, a raging challenge to the book's right to exist had brought it to national attention. Randall calls her novel an unauthorized parody of Gone with the Wind, the famous melodrama written by Margaret Mitchell, published in 1936. But the Mitchell estate quickly brought Randall's book to court, claiming that it isn't a parody, but simply an unauthorized sequel.
A derivative work based on the original, and thus The Wind Done Gone infringes upon the Mitchell Trust's copyright and other rights in Gone with the Wind.
District Court judge in Atlanta agreed and issued an injunction against its publication. Alice Randall.
Oh, I can't really talk that much about it. I'm not a lawyer or a politician. I'm a poet and a writer, but the Mitchell Trust did, I don't know what, try to get a temporary restraining order to keep my book from being published. And they briefly succeeded. So briefly, I had a banned book.
Briefly is the word. After about a month, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta lifted the injunction. No surprise there. Parody is protected by the Constitution and is defined as pointed criticism of an earlier work. The Wind Done Gone is definitely pointed and critical. And so it sailed into stores in its aura of controversy and within a few weeks had shot up the charts. Meantime, the Mitchell Estate's protests continued.
The Wind Done Gone's clear intent is to trade off the enormous and widespread appeal of Gone with the Wind, and consumers will be confused into thinking that the Mitchell Trusts have sponsored or endorsed this.
But even if the Margaret Mitchell Trusts don't have a legal leg to stand on, one question remains. Why did Alice Randall feel a need to respond, as she puts it, to a novel that the literary world has more or less unanimously declared mediocre and overrated?
I read the book when I was young, and I was shocked by it.
We asked, and she told us.
I think that it's a very potent piece of political propaganda that influences us as a country to this day. I think that it argues three points very persuasively, if untruthfully. One is the idea that black politicians are ineffectual. Two is the idea that blacks in general are unintelligent and animalistic. And three, and perhaps most noxious, is the idea that the proper role of the African-American mother is to take care of a white charge instead of caring for any child of her own.
And those are the points that Alice Randall very consciously counters with her own brand of melodramatic propaganda. Her post-Civil War Atlanta is a world in which all the black characters are well-rounded and sometimes brilliant, while all the whites are, well, flat and boring. Her heroine is Cinera, the mixed-race half-sister of Scarlett O'Hara. Cinera is an educated slave who tells her story through her diary.
If I strip the flesh off my bones like they strip the clothes off my flesh in the slave market down near the Battery in Charleston, this would be my skeleton. Childhood on a cotton farm. A time of shawl-fetched slavery away in Charleston. A bare-breasted hour on an auction block. Drudge slavery as a maid in beauty's Atlanta brothel. A season of candle flame concubinage in the attic of that house. A watery grand tour of Europe, and finally, concubinage in my own white clabbered home, with green shutters and gas lights, concubinage that persists till now. How many miles have I traveled to come back to here?
Well, this book is about freedom.
Again, Alice Randall.
It's about a text that frees itself from an earlier text and transforms an earlier text. The book begins in Reconstruction when she is living as a mistress to a man, R, who she has first come to know in the biblical sense when she was a slave he owned and had sex with.
So much was reconciled for me in his reach for my nipple before her breast, my kiss before her breath. So much reconciled and so much redeemed. Forever reconciled and forever redeemed.
And she moves from being a slave in his bed to a mistress in his bed, eventually to being a wife in his bed, and then she leaves him for a brilliant black congressman. Getting married was not enough for Sandra.
I liked R, sure enough. Liked him the way I liked God. I admired him and wanted things from him. I took my little petitions to him and they were answered.
So that takes care of Rhett Butler. But how, you may be asking, do Cinera and Scarlett O'Hara link up? Well, according to Randall, they don't. Not really.
Because Scarlett O'Hara lives forever in that horrible other book. And Cinera lives forever in my book. But in my book, there is a character called Other. O-T-H-E-R. She does not have a name. And one of the main reasons she doesn't have a name is a 1,000 pages in that other book. They did not give Mammy a name, so I didn't give Little White Other a name either.
They compared her to an elephant. They shouted down to their ancestors. She was big as an elephant with tiny dark round eyes. But she wasn't big enough to own a name. To me, she was big as a house. Big as 2 houses. I'd be scared to be that.
Where all the black characters in the other book, I think, were caricatures. It's hard to tell one mammy from another. In my book, it's very hard to tell one little white plantation girl from another. But I don't think any characters should be treated that way or any people should be treated that way. But when that shoe was on the other foot, people seemed to find it offensive.
For Randall, this flipping of the stick is the major joke of The Wind Done Gone. And as the book continues to sell like hotcakes, Alice Randall doesn't seem to mind a bit that some people aren't laughing.
Almost all the characters, even the white characters in my book, the apparent white book characters, turn out to be black in the end, which is my way of including everybody. If you will embrace your inner blackness, you can be included in the feast of this table.
The part of Cinera was played by Nafisa Monroe. The lawyer was played by Brian DeShacer. Research for this segment was provided by George Hoagland.
And that piece, based on Alice Randall's book, The Wind Done Gone, a provocative literary parody that explodes the mythology perpetrated by the Southern classic Gone with the Wind. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the Radio Griot Project, written and produced by Roy Hurst of KPFK. We're going to come back to look at W.E.B. Du Bois in this African American History Month special. Stay with us.
He's got a little bit of baby. In his hands, he's got the whole world in his hands. He's got you and me, brother. In his hands, he's got you and me, sister. In his hands, he's got you and me, brother. In his hands, he's got the whole world in his hands. Oh, he's got everybody. In his hands, he's got everybody. In his hands, he's got everybody here. Right in his hands, he's got the whole world in his hands.
Marian Anderson singing, he's got the whole world in his hands, the historic 1963 March on Washington as she stood next to Martin Luther King. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. W.E.B. Du Bois would have been 134 years old on Saturday. During his life, he wrote more than 4,000 works. One of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in 1910, he helped organize the first Universal Races Congress and the first annual Pan-African Congress. Du Bois returned to the NAACP in 1944 as director of special research, but in 1951 he was indicted under the McCarran Act after calling upon the United Nations to hear the crimes of the U.S. government against its own people. Today we will hear the story of another epic saga, a saga of the African-American people, that of the life of W.E.B. Du Bois. And while he never achieved the mass acceptance enjoyed by the other African-American leader of his time, Booker T. Washington, the legacy of W.E.B. Du Bois is a consistent, deep concern for people of color and for economic justice for all people around the world. This piece, again produced by Radio Griot, a program devoted to storytelling. It's written and narrated by Roy Hurst of Pacifica Station KPFK. We go to W.E.B. Du Bois, Scholarship and Propaganda, The Makings of a Race Man.
W.E.B. Du Bois, Scholarship and Propaganda, The Makings of a Race Man.
Jericho, Jericho, Jericho.
The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, the relation of the darker to the lighter races of men in Asia and Africa, in America and the islands of the sea.
The prophetic power of the words W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in 1903 was never more evident than in 1963 on the day he died. Within hours of his death, a quarter of a million people would be gathered at the Lincoln Monument in what would become known as the Civil Rights March on Washington.
May I have your attention, ladies and gentlemen? I regret to
And yet, when the news went out to the crowd that the great 95-year-old scholar and activist had gone, the irony of his passing at that historic moment in time seemed lost on them, or perhaps ignored. Du Bois had died in Accra, Ghana, a black nationalist, a Pan-Africanist, a communist, in self-imposed exile. It was the McCarthy era, and civil rights leadership didn't dare embrace the blacklisted, even if he was the architect of their movement, even if he was now dead.
Let us have a moment of silence in honor of this great proponent of civil rights.
But Du Bois had never quite been the leader of his people, although it was his boyhood aspiration. He was first and foremost an intellectual, one of the brilliant minds of the early 20th century, driven to solve the Negro problem through social science.
These are my plans: to make a name in social science, to make a name in literature, and thus to raise my race.
In 1892, on his 25th birthday, he was in Berlin furthering his education at the most prestigious university in the world. He drank a bottle of wine to celebrate and made an entry in his diary.
Or perhaps to raise a visible empire in Africa through England, France, or Germany. I wonder what will be the outcome. Who knows? I will go unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish.
And if Du Bois was ambitious, he was also supremely confident, with a solid reputation for being aloof and arrogant.
I rejoice as a strong man to run a race, and I am strong. Is it egotism? Is it assurance? Or is it the silent call of the world spirit that makes me feel that I am royal and that beneath my scepter a world of kings shall bow?
It was a disposition that would never gain him the mass acceptance enjoyed by another leader of his day, the great accommodator.
In our humble way,
Booker T. Washington,
we shall stand by you with devotion that no foreigner can approach.
Still, as the embodiment of the Negro Brain Trust, Du Bois commanded a great deal of attention. For more than 60 years, his scholarship and propaganda diligently stripped away at white supremacy, and his feud with Washington is legendary. Radio Griot asks, what was the nature of that feud, and what do we make of Du Bois' elitism, his piercing sense of destiny, and his tenacious drive toward a scientific solution to his people's plight?
The Negro race, like all races, is going to be saved by its exceptional men.
We might begin to find answers in his controversial theory on the talented 10th,
The problem of education, then, among Negroes, must first of all deal with the talented tenth. It is the problem of developing the best of this race that they may guide the mass away from the contamination and death of the worst in their own and other races.
Du Bois's concept of talented tenth has gone in, I think, for more reproach and diagnosis and dismemberment than almost any other aspect of his thinking, and I think greatly misunderstood.
David Levering Lewis is a professor of history at Rutgers University. He's published two highly acclaimed volumes on Du Bois.
In a nutshell, Du Bois believed that it was the obligation of the educated element in the population of color to provide the leadership. Who else is going to lead, said he. And that the kind of leadership that was to be provided was to be uncompromisingly militant when it came to civil rights and to full equality, and in the area of education and professional advancement, to demand all that Americans in the mainstream enjoyed.
Can the masses of the Negro people be in any possible way more quickly raised than by the effort and example of this aristocracy of talent and character? Was there ever a nation on God's fair earth civilized from the bottom upward? Never. It is, ever was, and ever will be from the top downward that culture filters.
Of course, that was an elitist construct, but it was an elitism which was principled, which made sense to Du Bois only because to those to whom much is given, much is expected. That was really how he looked upon it.
The talented tenth rises and pulls all that are worth saving up to their vantage ground. This is the history of human progress, and the two historic mistakes which have hindered that progress were the thinking first that no more could ever rise save the few already risen, or second, that it would be better the unrisen to pull the risen down.
Du Bois, though, unlike most of the members of the Talented Tenth, came to socialism early. And that will distinguish him increasingly from people who march with him.
Oh, my baby, my curly-headed baby, just tuck your head like little bird beneath its mother's wing.
William Edward Bogart Du Bois was born in 1868. A Negro of mixed background in the mountains of Massachusetts, where his family had been farmers for some five generations. From the very outset, he stood apart academically from other children, so much so that the state's clergy awarded him a scholarship to the finest black college of his day, Fisk University. From there, he went on to Harvard, graduated in 1890, becoming the first African American to achieve such distinction. Already, he was showing definite signs of a race leader. Once again, David Levering Lewis.
When he graduated, by the way, from Harvard, he gave the graduation address, the Jefferson Davis address, which rocked the nation.
I wish to consider not the man, but the type of civilization which his life represented. Its foundation is the idea of the strong man, individualism coupled with the rule of might.
Imagine the chutzpah, the cheek of this young black boy from these modest circumstances standing on the dais at Harvard, giving a critical assessment of the strengths and shortcomings of the icon of the South, Jefferson Davis.
Now advancing civilization by murdering Indians, and finally, as the crowning absurdity, the peculiar champion of the people fighting to be free in order that another people should not be free.
It was beautifully done. It was diplomatic, but between the lines, he censured white supremacy.
Young Du Bois would go on to study economics in Berlin, teach Latin and Greek to Negroes in Ohio, and publish his first groundbreaking book, The Suppression of the African Slave Trade to the United States of America. Now, with his prestige growing, he receives an offer from the University of Pennsylvania to make a study of the black population of Philadelphia. Out of this comes his second book, one of the most significant works in American sociology, the 1899 publication of The Philadelphia Negro.
And what was so remarkable about that book was...
Again, David Levering Lewis.
This was an empirical study. This was a time when sociologists talked a lot about data, about the science of a society. But they did it from armchairs, and they did it from preconceptions, and they did it from a priorism. Du Bois goes out and knocks on doors throughout the 8th Ward of Philadelphia, startling people as they open the door to see this man with handlebar mustaches in the Kaiser Wilhelm mode and spats and a cane, asking them the most personal questions.
Yes?
Good afternoon, madam.
Afternoon.
My name is W.E.B. Du Bois. I wonder if I could speak to the head of the household.
About what?
I'm conducting a survey on the American Negro.
The door was shut but a few times in his face, I gather, as he interviewed thousands of people, made tabulations, and came up with this, as I say, path-breaking study.
May I speak to the head of the household, please?
Henry? There's a man.
The Philadelphia Negro was also filled with Du Bois's leadership theories, and it was more than a bit critical of its subject.
The Negro has much to learn of the Jew and Italian as to living within his means and saving every penny from excessive and wasteful expenditures.
It was to be reproached by younger sociologists as the years passed as a kind of victim-blaming document. And it is true, it is written in the Victorian language of why can't these people shape up? But he also said things about the economics of their situation. And he also talked about class. And until this time, no one had ever detected class in the African-American community. There were only Negroes who were good or bad as far as white America was concerned. But here he talks about hardworking families and families that are affluent and families that have education and families that have gentility. So he produced a complex portrait of the people of Philadelphia. And then he dared to say the denial of jobs and opportunity was at the root of the race problem. This was quite startling.
Du Bois went on to conduct a similar study in Atlanta and in the process sealed a reputation as the most distinguished academic in black America.
But as he produces these remarkable social science works, he continues to say that if the world but would underwrite, promote hard social science about race relations, he would soon come up with a solution.
Frustrated by the lack of funding for his work in Atlanta, Du Bois commented,
"If Negroes were lost in Africa, money would be available to measure their heads. But $500 a year is hard to raise for Atlanta."
This was, of course, the delusion that an intellectual and a scholar often falls into. Give me the NEH grant, give me the MacArthur grant, and I'll give you information that will transform society. Well, scholarship does transform society, but never as quickly as we would like. And Du Bois realized that his impact was negligible, that indeed race relations were deteriorating, racism was augmenting. And Du Bois decided he would have to add to scholarship propaganda.
One could not be a calm, cool, and detached scientist while Negroes were lynched, murdered, and starved.
So he embarks upon an organization called the Niagara Movement of like-minded men and affiliated women who wish to speed up the business of the acquisition of denied civil rights. And out of that activity comes, of course, the confrontation with the man who spoke then for black America, Booker T. Washington.
This is Radio Griot.
Part 2, Booker T. and W.E.B.
A ship lost at sea for many days suddenly sighted a friendly vessel. From the mast of the unfortunate vessel was seen a signal. "Water, water, we die of thirst." The answer from the friendly vessel at once came back. "Cast down your bucket where you are."
By 1903, Booker T. Washington was the undisputed leader of black America. Born a slave, Washington was largely self-educated and had managed to found a school for black teachers in the heart of Alabama's Black Belt. It was called Tuskegee Institute. From his post as principal, Washington shrewdly presided over all things Negro. 8 years earlier, his influence had been ordained by the Southern white power structure on the strength of a speech given at the Cotton States Exposition in Atlanta.
To those of my race who depend on bettering their condition in foreign land, or who underestimate the importance of cultivating friendly relations with the Southern white man who is their next door neighbor, I would say, cast down your buckets where you are.
The speech became known as the Atlanta Compromise. In it, Washington proposed to trade black America's pursuit of civil rights for low-level economic opportunity.
Cast it down in commerce, in domestic service, and in the profession.
It was music to the ears of the white South that was expressing a sometimes violent rage against its former slaves, whom it saw as attempting to step out of its proper place of subservience. Washington proposed to fix all that by accommodating white expectations.
As we have proved our loyalty to you in the past, in nursing your children, watching by the sick bed of your mothers and fathers, and often following them with tear-dimmed eyes to their graves, so in the future, in our humble way, we shall stand by you with devotion that no foreigner can approach, ready to lay down our lives, if need be, in defense of yours, interlacing our industrial, commercial, civil, and religious life with yours in a way that shall make the interests of both races one. In all things purely social, we can be as separate as the five fingers, and yet one as the hand in all things essential to mutual progress.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you, sir. Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Washington, let me heartily congratulate you upon your phenomenal success at Atlanta. It was a word fitly spoken. Your comrade in arms, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Du Bois came to oppose Booker T. Washington rather slowly, actually. He applauded Booker Washington's Atlanta Compromise speech. Indeed, remarkably, Du Bois said that voting was a privilege, not a right, and he was not sure that everybody should vote. But when Booker T. Washington began to pronounce about educational policy, which Du Bois thought a great deal about, Du Bois became increasingly troubled.
To be troubled was one thing, but to speak out was something altogether different. With the backing of white philanthropists, Booker T. Washington had erected an effective lobbying apparatus designed in part to squash any dissent among Negroes. It was known as the Tuskegee Machine. Later, Du Bois would write,
"Things came to such a pass that when any Negro complained or advocated a course of action, he would be silenced with the remark that Mr. Washington did not agree with this. Naturally, the bumptious, irritated young black intelligentsia of the day declared, 'I don't care a damn what Booker Washington thinks. This is what I think, and I have a right to think.'"
And finally, he opposed Booker T. Washington on the issue of whether or not a small percentage of the black population must not have the kind of education that would fit them for positions of command and leadership, as opposed to the vocational training that Dr. Washington prescribed for almost everybody.
"No race can prosper until it learns that there is as much dignity in tilling a field as in riding a pole."
This is an age of unusual economic development, and Mr. Washington's program naturally takes an economic cast, becoming a gospel of work and money to such an extent as apparently almost completely to overshadow the higher aims of life.
And so, while Du Bois never denied the value and utility of vocationalism, it was Booker T. Washington's refusal to admit the value of liberal arts education that caused them to part company. But from that dissent, Du Bois looked again at the whole issue of the Atlanta Compromise and realized, it didn't take long, that you cannot have a bargain in which you've given up the right to vote. You have no leverage. And so, in 1903, he announced his his descent in that famous work, The Souls of Black Folk, in an essay contained in that work called Of Dr. Booker T. Washington and Others.
It has been claimed that the Negro can survive only through submission. Mr. Washington distinctly asks that black people give up, at least for the present, three things. First, political power. Second, insistence on civil rights. Third, higher education of Negro youth. And concentrate all of their energies on industrial education, the accumulation of wealth, and the conciliation of the South.
We can be as separate as the five fingers, and yet...
As a result of this tender of the palm branch, what has been the return? In these years, there have occurred the disfranchisement of the Negro, the legal creation of a distinct status of civil inferiority for the Negro, the steady withdrawal of aid from institutions for higher training of the Negro.
Progress must be the result of severe and constant struggle rather than of artificial force.
The question then comes, is it possible and probable that 9 millions of men can make effective progress in economic lines if they are deprived of political rights, made a servile caste, and allowed only the most meager chance of developing their exceptional men? If history and reason give any distinct answer to these questions, it is an emphatic no.
And Booker Washington would never recover from that essay. It was a definitive denunciation in the most eloquent language.
For young black intellectuals, The Souls of Black Folk became the political Bible, and W.E.B. Du Bois was now being honored as the long-looked-for political messiah. At last, his quest to lead had been achieved.
And so then black America divides into two camps, unequal, with Booker Washington having the big guns. But by 1910, Du Bois has the support not only of a minuscule group of African American intellectuals and professionals, but of the progressive whites who decide that Booker T. Washington's agenda, while perhaps viable in the South, is no answer to the race problem in the North as more and more African Americans begin to migrate north.
The result of that rethinking was the 1910 founding of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Du Bois now leaves the classroom and joins the organization he's helped to found. And with the success of The Souls of Black Folk, Du Bois was certain that if the NAACP was to be effective, it would need a vehicle for its radical ideas.
And to the surprise of the white officers of the NAACP, he says, I'm going to create a magazine. So we have no money for this. We didn't ask you to do it. There are enough magazines, aren't there, anyway? And Du Bois went right ahead and created the Crisis, which becomes the NAACP. It is the voice of civil rights militancy. He's a full-time propagandist.
Wasn't that a mighty day, O Lord? A mighty day, O Lord!
In Du Bois' hands, the Crisis magazine steadfastly indicted racism and stated the case for civil rights. But it also reflected Du Bois' interest in Negro art, in African history, in women's rights, world peace, Pan-Africanism, black nationalism, and socialism. Along the way, Du Bois would continue to see himself as the intellectual savior of his race, but his leadership would be one of ideas and principles rather than tactics and political organizing. In the final pages of his autobiography, Dusk of Dawn, Du Bois stated his own view of his early contributions.
I was a main factor in revolutionizing the attitude of the American Negro toward caste. My stinging hammer made Negroes aware of themselves, confident in their possibilities, and determined in self-assertion. So much so that today common slogans among the Negro people are taken bodily from the words of my mouth.
Over the years, Du Bois would continue to find himself at odds with other black leaders, most notably the black nationalist Marcus Garvey. But Du Bois would also feud with executives of the NAACP. His ever-expanding ideas about solutions to the Negro problem resulted in a conversion to communism and the promotion of a self-segregated black economy. At the end of his days, he would be regarded by younger civil rights leaders as ideologically off track, as he'd once regarded Booker T. Washington.
He was airbrushed out of history.
Once again, David Levering Lewis.
Because his politics after World War II took him so far left that in the teeth of the McCarthy hysteria, he was an embarrassment to the people he had worked with, who did not wish to be tainted with communist charges, which would, of course, have destroyed, for example, the NAACP. So, yes, Du Bois defies the trajectory of almost every other American's life. We get tired, we get fixed in ideas, and we say, okay, this is not to be, we've done our best. Du Bois becomes more radical at 95 than he was at 25. And that is the extraordinary profile of his witness and odyssey.
Perhaps above all, I am proud of a straightforward clearness of reason. In part a gift of the gods, but also to no little degree to scientific training and inner discipline. By means of this, I have met life face to face. I have loved to fight, and I have realized that love is God, and work is his prophet, that his ministers are age and death.
David Levering Lewis is a professor of history at Rutgers University. The part of W.E.B. Du Bois was played by Dominic Hoffman and Booker T. Washington by Ben Guillory. Additional voices, Charles Allen and Wren Woods. Much thanks to the Roby Theater Company for its help with this project. Production assistance provided by moi. Radio Griot is written, directed, and produced by Roy Hurst. I'm Esperl Sharp. We'll see you next time on Radio Griot.
If you'd like more information about Radio Griot, email us at griot21@earthlink.net. That's griott21@earthlink.net.
W.E.B. Du Bois, Scholarship and Propaganda, The Makings of a Race Man, produced by Radio Griot, a program devoted to storytelling. It was written and narrated by Roy Hurst. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
I was born by the river in a little tent, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come. Oh yeah. He said it's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die.
Sam Cooke's tune, A Change Is Gonna Come, sung by Aretha Franklin. Here on Democracy Now!, this is the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. 37 years ago today, Malcolm X was assassinated. One of the greatest leaders in this country, he was shot to death as he spoke before a packed audience in Harlem's Audubon Ballroom. He was just 39 years old. In honor of his memory, today we turn to a rare speech, which we have audio and video footage. This is Malcolm X.
If those of us who believe in black nationalism spend all of our time thinking only about Africa, which is about 9,000 miles away with a great deal of water in between, we will place our people here in the same position that they were placed in by the preacher during slavery, where they would dream about someplace way up in the sky. Because many of our people see going back to Africa just as difficult as the non-religious Negro now thinks in terms of getting up to a city in the sky somewhere. So we have to have a new approach, a new appraisal. And this new appraisal and new approach has to be in tune with the reality of the conditions that we are in after having been thoroughly brainwashed by this blue-eyed white man. Some of them have brown eyes. Those of us who believe in black nationalism, who believe that we should migrate to our African homeland, on ourselves to see that new bridges must be built. Because in the minds of the majority of our people today, Africa is too far away. So the only way you and I can point them in that direction is build new bridges. We have to have the type of understanding of Africa and the type of understanding of our people here in order to build a bridge, a contact, a line of communication between the two. And once the lines of communication have been established, and our African brothers can stretch forth their hands and reach out, and we can stretch forth our hands and reach them, why, there's nothing that this blue-eyed man in this country will be able to do to you and me successfully from that day onward. Our African homeland, in other words, must be brought nearer. And our African brothers and sisters must be brought nearer. Not only must they be brought nearer to us, but we must be brought nearer to them. And the first step, for those of us who believe in the philosophy of black nationalism, we have to realize that the problem begins right here. The first problem is right here. We have to elevate our thinking right here first. Not just the thinking of a handful, that won't do it. But the thinking of 22 million black people in this country must be elevated. They must be made to see it as we see it. They must be made to think as we think. And then they'll be ready to act, just like we're ready to act. The black nationalists don't realize this. The black nationalists will fail as other groups have failed. Any philosophy that you have that can't be implemented is no good. A preaching or a gospel is no better than its ability to be carried out in a manner that will make it beneficial to the people who accept it. When you have a philosophy or a gospel, I don't care whether it's a religious gospel, a political gospel, an economic gospel, or a social gospel. If it's not going to do something for you and me right here, right now, to hell with that gospel. In the past, most of the religious gospels that you and I have heard have benefited only those who preach it. Most of the political gospels that you and I have heard have benefited only the politicians. The social gospels have benefited only the sociologists. You and I need something right now that's going to benefit all of us, that's going to change the community in which we live, not try and take us somewhere else. If we can't live here, we never will live somewhere else. Number one, why is it so difficult to get so many of our people in this country interested in going to Africa? And I have to point this out because today the entire question has reached a new level of thought. There was a time when you talk about going back to Africa, you hear it out on the corner, 125th Street and 7th Avenue. But today on college campuses across the country, you have students who are interested in nationalism. Nationalism is the wave of the present and the future. It is nationalism that's bringing freedom to oppressed people all over the world. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Algerians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Nigerians and to the Ghanaians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the people of Uganda and Tanganyika and Sudan and Somaliland. It was nationalism that has brought about the freedom of every oppressed people. They have studied the tactics and the strategy and the methods of all of the African nations who have emerged and won their independence. And they've seen that the Africans didn't get it by sitting in. They didn't get it by waiting in. They didn't get it by singing, "We Shall Overcome." They got it through nationalism. And you and I will get it through nationalism. What is it that makes it difficult for the philosophy of nationalism to spread among the so-called Negroes? Number one, they think they have a stake in America. They think they have an investment in this country, which we do. We invested 310 years of slave labor, 310 years, every day of which You and my mother and father worked for nothing. Not 8 hours a day. There was no union in that day. They worked from sun up until sundown. From can't see in the morning until can't see at night. They never had a day off. And on Sunday, they were allowed to sit down and sing about when they die, they wouldn't be slaves no more. When they die, they wouldn't be slaves no more. They'd go up in the sky, and every day would be Sunday. That's a shame. And it is that 310 years of slave labor that went in, that was my and your contribution into this particular economy and political system. If those of us who are in this audience right now were to take our individual equality of opportunity, if the Constitution at the present time can change it, either it offers it or it doesn't offer it. If it offers it, good, give it to us. If it doesn't offer it, then change it. You don't need a debate. You don't need a filibuster. You need some action. You and I should let them know now that either we collect our investment right here, right now, and then if we can't collect it here, our people will then be ready to go back home. Let's go ahead and join in with them and make this man pay these back wages. They can give us the back pay. Let's join in. If this is what the Negro wants, let's join him. Let's show him how to struggle. Let's show him how to fight. Let's show him how to bring about a real revolution. Let's make him stop jiving. If you're interested in freedom, you need some judo, you need some karate, you need all the things that will help you fight for freedom. They have not wanted the black nationalists involved in the civil rights struggle because the black nationalists are too militant and they don't compromise. They proved that at the United Nations when the Mumba was murdered. Since we know that they don't want the black nationalists involved in the civil rights struggle because black nationalists are too militant and won't compromise, we've got to get involved. We have to expose the subterfuge and the trickery, of the white liberal who's posing as a friend of our people in this country, keeping us barking in the wrong direction. And in order to, and once we get involved, we have to give an entirely new interpretation to the entire civil rights struggle so that the door will then be open for all of our people to become involved at a level or on a level that they best understand. And the only simplified way to explain it is we want equality of opportunity. And this doesn't conflict with what Mr. Muhammad taught me, because on the back of the newspaper, Muhammad speaks, it plainly states that if the man is not going to let our people go back home or isn't going to give us some territory somewhere else, then we demand equality of opportunity.
Malcolm X, he was assassinated 37 years ago today. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Our website is democracynow.org. I look forward to seeing people Friday night, tomorrow night, at University of Vermont. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! Truth is gonna set yourself free. Ooh, hey, hey, oh. Truth is gonna set yourself free. Yes, it will. Ooh, it never fails. It's guaranteed.